excellent and expensive clothing at a glance, and he came forward, rubbing his hands together to smile broadly at them. "We're quite busy, as you can see, but we'll clear you a table in a moment." Benedict's stomach made a noise audible even over the chatter of the room.
"Wonderful," he said.
"We also have need of lodging, sir," Gwendolen said. "We've been told your establishment can serve our needs."
The innkeeper rubbed at his neck.
"Ah, miss, I see. We'll be happy to get a hot meal into your bellies, travellers, but I'm afraid my rooms are all spoken for."
"I beg your pardon?" Gwen said, smiling. "I'm not sure I heard you correctly."
"Well, miss," the innkeeper said, "times being what they are, what with an attack and maybe a war and so on, we've no rooms to rent, I'm afraid."
"They're full right now?" Gwendolen asked. "Every one of them?"
"I'm sorry, but they are," the innkeeper lied.
It was patently obvious from the expression on his face. Perhaps, Bridget reflected, turning down money was not something an entrepreneur of Havel Landing was emotionally equipped to take in his stride. But why wouldn't he simply rent her the rooms if that was the case?
Ah, it doubtless had to do with...
"Who is renting them?" Gwen asked brightly.
"Perhaps I could make some sort of bargain with that person."
"That's not any business of yours, miss. Meaning no offence, but I don't go blabbing about my customers or their business."
"I'm sure we can reach some kind of understanding," Gwendolen stated.
"No rooms," the innkeeper said, his jaw setting stubbornly.
Gwendolen Lancaster narrowed her eyes. They decided to take their dinner in their suite, rather than shouldering their way into the Black Horse's common room. One of the women from downstairs delivered it on several stacked trays. The food came in, hot and fresh, on the best plates the Black Horse had to offer, along with genuine silverware and several rather expensive bottles of mist wine. Once the food had been set out on the room's small table, the serving woman left, and Folly shut and latched the door carefully behind her. The etherealist's apprentice looked wan, as if she hadn't eaten in days. Once the door was closed, the girl immediately hurried to the corner of the room farthest from it and settled down on the floor, holding her little jar of crystals carefully.
"Guz," Benedict said, opening the first bottle of mist wine. "I'm afraid you may have a thing or two to learn about bargaining for the best possible price."
"It isn't my task to save money," Gwen replied rather tartly. "I'm here to save time."
"Impossible, impossible," Master Ferris said. "Time is time. We can barely even see it, much less alter it."
Benedict poured the wine into their glasses calmly, despite his stomach's rumblings, before he seated himself and began to fill his plate. His motions, Bridget noted, were not hurried, but she could see the cords in his neck standing out with the effort of his restraint.
"Not time, then," Gwen said, "but trouble.
Yes, we paid 5 times the price."
10 times, Benedict interjected gently. Gwen waved her hand.
"The point is, we aren't wasting hours running back and forth to the temple until we find another inn."
"Point, child, a fair point," Master Ferris said.
"Little mouse," said Raoul, rather pointedly from the floor, "where should I sit?"
Bridget calmly cleared a little space on the table, put some roasted fowl on a small plate, and lifted Raoul up to the table to sit before it. The cat made a pleased, throaty sound and began nibbling away.
"If I may ask," Bridget asked hesitantly, "what is our next move?"
"Exploit the environment," Master Ferris said around a mouthful of beef. "The room below is an excellent place to sample the local climate for signs of unusual activity. Sir Sorrelin, perhaps you would be willing to employ your talents to go down and listen. Pretend to be drinking, but don't become impaired."
Benedict swallowed hurriedly and cleared his throat.
Master Ferris,
I fear that the Spyrarch's orders prevent me from doing any such thing. I'm to stay within arm's reach of you.
The old etherealist blinked.
I suppose your orders could be interpreted that way, couldn't they?
Interpreted literally, Benedict said. I'm afraid so.
That being the case, Ferris said, I will accompany you. It will add verisimilitude to have someone who is genuinely drunk at the table.
He shook his head sadly.
Death is light as a feather. Duty as heavy as a spire. What?
Ah, Benedict said. Master Ferris, is that wise? Gwen asked.
It's an ancient proverb, handed down from the time of the builders. Ferris replied. Chronologically speaking, it is wisdom of the highest order.
Not the proverb, Gwen said.
You, inebriated. It seems to me that you might have more difficulty pursuing your mission if you are drunk.
I should far rather be drunk than eaten, Miss Lancaster,
Ferris said in a serious tone.
As should we all.
Very well. That's settled. Gwen blinked. The etherealist took a slow sip from his glass and nodded owlishly. Master Sorrelin and I will confront and destroy several more bottles of this rather excellent mist wine, and see what news can be passively gleaned.
Meanwhile,
the rest of you will go with Raoul and Bridget to make contact with the local cats. If anything out of the ordinary is happening in Habble Landing, they'll have noticed it.
Raoul looked up from his food to say,
He said my name first, little mouse. He has an excellent sense of priorities.
Bridget eyed Raoul and then looked back at the old man.
Master Ferris, forgive me, but I'm not sure exactly how long it might take to make contact. Cats are not known for their forthright hospitality when it comes to meeting strangers.
I'll help, Gwen said calmly. Bridget sighed.
I think your help in this particular endeavour might be counterproductive.
Gwen frowned.
In what way? God in heaven, she really doesn't realize what she's like when she's bearing down on some poor soul, Bridget thought.
Aloud, she said,
Cats don't react well to...
She faltered and looked over at Benedict, silently pleading for help.
Gwen, miss, Benedict said. Gwen lifted an eyebrow.
In what way precisely did you mean that remark, cuz?
In precisely every way, Benedict replied.
Your diplomatic efforts so far have consisted of instigating a duel, threatening detachment of Fleet Marines with charges of treason, throwing away a tidy little fortune in bribes, and abruptly discharging a gauntlet into an otherwise non-violent situation.
But,
Gwen began.
Twice, Benedict said mildly.
Gwen regarded him steadily and gave her next bite of fowl a particularly stiff jab of a fork.
I don't mean to insult you, Gwen, but cats don't react well to the kind of pressure you bring to bear,
Bridget said.
Especially not when they're dealing with...
Invaders,
Raoul muttered.
Newcomers, Bridget finished mildly.
Gwen rolled her eyes and said,
Very well. I shall keep myself out from underfoot then. It's just for the first meeting,
Bridget said quickly. Benedict frowned at Bridget.
You shouldn't go alone.
She isn't,
the etherealist said.
Folly will be with her.
Bridget glanced at Folly. The girl was bouncing her little jar of crystals gently and singing them a very quiet lullaby. Benedict arched an eyebrow and said,
Ah.
It's all right, Bridget said. Fewer people mean less noise. Raoul will be able to hear potential threats well before they can come near enough to harm us.
Raoul groomed one of his front paws modestly.
Right then, Master Ferris said. That's settled as well. Go forth. Good hunting. Sir Benedict, let's get drunk.
Chapter 28. Spire Albion, Habel Landing Shipyards, AMS Predator. Grimm descended from the deck to the engineering section just as the engineers were carefully opening the crates marked with the crest of the Lancaster Vettery.
Ah!
Journeyman cackled, rubbing his broad, calloused hands together. The stocky, balding engineer was sweating despite the pleasantly cool afternoon. They had grounded the ship and throttled down her core crystal only about half an hour before, and the excess heat shared by the ship's power conduits had not yet dissipated. Currently, electricity was running only to the lumen crystals and the kitchen.
Finally! Carefully now, man! If you crack one of my new crystals, I'll hoist you up on a spike!
Grimm cleared his throat calmly. Journeyman squinted over his shoulder.
Ah! He said. That is, I will report you to the proper person in the chain of command who will make decisions about discipline that are not mine to make.
Always good to maintain discipline in your section, Chief, Grimm said pleasantly. Even in a civilian vessel. Journeyman flicked Grimm a quick salute and snorted.
Freddy's a warship, Skipper. We all know that.
Grimm shrugged a shoulder. When need be, Chief. Are the new parts up to spec? Journeyman waved a hand vaguely at the far workbench, where 8 green-white crystals, the size of a man's head, sat in an orderly row in a long crate, like eggs in a nest.
Those are the new trim crystals, and they're first rate. You can still smell the solution from the vat on them.
Grimm glanced at Journeyman sharply. Trim crystals of varying quality were often to be found, but never new ones. New trim crystals tended to be more efficient and more sensitive to varying degrees of current, and then gradually degraded with use. A ship with new trim crystals was slightly but significantly more maneuverable than one without, which was why they were universally snapped up by the Ethereum fleet as rapidly as they were produced.
They're new.
Journeyman gave Grimm a gap-toothed grin.
Bet your fancy silk suit on it, Skip.
Grimm shook his head slowly, partly in answer to Journeyman and partly in slowly dawning realization of the amount of debt into which he had been placed. Predator would have been nimble even if the Spyrarch had provided used lift crystals. With new ones, she could dance with the finest in the world. The last crate finally came open with a groan, and the engineering crew carefully broke it down around the last crystal. An enormous oblong shape the size of a bathtub, its emerald surface faceted so finely that except for a few glitters of light upon it, it looked round and smooth. The lift crystal would socket into the suspension rig, the ship's structural foundation, and when they were in flight, all the weight of Predator would be spread across the crystal surface.
Gorgeous,
Journeyman crooned, approaching the crystal with his hands outstretched.
Oh, you beautiful thing. Come here, come here.
Grimm arched an eyebrow. Ought I leave the two of you alone? Journeyman sniffed haughtily, and then knelt down beside the crystal, running his hands over its surface. He muttered to himself, then started pulling probes and gauges from his tool belt. He popped a pair of engineer's optics over his nose, flicked several different lenses into place, and squinted at the crystal surface, prodding and muttering. Grimm gave him several minutes to study the lift crystal before he cleared his throat again.
Mr. Journeyman.
Been some kind of mistake, Skip,
Journeyman muttered. Grimm leaned forward.
Mistake? How so?
The journeyman hooked up a set of probes to a power outlet and touched them to the big crystal. Radiant spirals of light began to flow through the crystal just beneath where the probes touched. Journeyman eyed the spirals through his optics, then flicked them out of the way with an annoyed hand and did it again, this time watching a gauge to which the probes were attached.
Yep, definitely a mistake.
What's wrong with it, Chief?
Oh, not a damn thing, Skip.
Journeyman said.
Brand new. And one of their Mark IVs to boot. Efficient as hell.
Journeyman, Grim reminded himself, was a genius with etheric technology. That was why they had managed to return home to Albion with an almost completely non-functional lift crystal in the first place. Journeyman had rigged the trim crystals to carry a load for which they had never been designed, and more or less burned them out in the process. He was a damned fine engineer, but at times Grim wished he could be a bit less of a genius child entirely absorbed by his toys.
"Then what's the mistake, Chief?"
Journeyman turned to squint at Grim.
"This is a battle cruiser's lift crystal, Skip, or I'm a shiny new Wally Pog ensign."
Grim grunted, frowning. Capital ships used multiple heavy crystals to maintain their altitude, and the crystals tended to be denser and more complex, which made them more energy efficient. The sheer mass of a large ship's structure and armor demanded nothing less. If what Journeyman said was true, that lift crystal could easily keep a ship 35 times Predator's mass aloft. They'd have to be careful of how much power they fed to the crystal, or its raw power might tear it free of the suspension rig entirely. It was altogether possible that Predator might be able to climb faster than she could dive with a crystal like that to lift her.
"What kind of altitude could she take us to, Chief?"
Journeyman scratched his ear with one broken nailed finger.
7? Maybe 8 miles? Way higher than we could breathe without tanks, anyway. For all practical purposes, she won't have an operational ceiling. And she's real efficient at lower altitude. Won't have to dump a quarter of the power we used to from the core into this sweetheart to keep us in the air.
One of the engineering crew let out a low whistle, and Grim felt himself in heartfelt agreement with the sentiment. The largest part of a ship's power budget was allotted to its lift crystal. Less energy spent on keeping the ship afloat meant more power that could be used for other systems. They could get more speed out of the etheric web by charging it more highly, increase the density of Predator's shroud, and fire her cannon until their copper barrels melted. The Spyrarch had given them parts of such quality that, when combined with her exceptional core crystal, Predator was about to become the fastest airship in Albion's fleet, as fierce as any military vessel in her own class, with the ability to pour fire from her cannon that a cruiser might envy. It didn't mean that Predator could take on a true armored warship like a Tusker. But she would be far more elusive and difficult to bring down with a lucky shot, and any ship lighter than a Tusker would get a very nasty surprise if it engaged Grimm's little ship.
"I love you,"
Journeyman said to the lift crystal. He kissed it and spread his arms across its surface in an embrace.
"I love you, you big, beautiful beast. I want you to marry me. I want you to bear my children."
"Chief," Grim said reproachfully, but his heart wasn't in it. Addison Albion had come through on his promise to a degree that Grim could scarcely encompass. Grim tried to calculate the cost of the Spyrarch's largesse, and realized that he couldn't. Crystals like that weren't for sale. They were priceless, and they would make his ship into something far more swift and fearsome and efficient than she had ever been before. The Spyrarch had known that Grim had no intention of taking service to him. But he had sent these crystals anyway. How did one in good conscience pay back a debt that by its very nature could not be calculated? How could Grim turn his back on such a gesture of faith and walk away after a single errand? If there was a way to do so, he certainly did not see it. Lord Albion, Grim decided, was something of a judge of character.
"How long until you've got them all installed, Chief?"
he asked. Journeyman looked up from the crystal and squinted around the section, evidently gathering his thoughts.
"Trim crystals won't take but a day," he said, They're standardized, and we can swap them out pretty quick. This lovely beast, though.
He rubbed his hands over the lift crystal surface again.
This might take some time. Our suspension rig can handle her, but not until I make some modifications.
How long?
And then there are the power runs, Journeyman said. We'll have to install some resistors to reduce the current, or those trim crystals will have us spinning upside down in mid-air the first time Kettle tries to bank. And we'll have to lay new runs to the web nodes, so that we can feed more current to the web.
How long?
And there's the Haslett cages to consider, too. I'll have to calibrate them to account for the increased efficiency, and the cause cage, too, to let us run up a thicker shroud.
Chief, Grimm said, keeping his patience with effort. How long?
Journeyman shrugged.
A month, maybe?
If Grimm knew his engineer, he'd still be fussing over and massaging his new crystals into increased performance 6 months from now.
There's a war on, Chief. How long for the quick and dirty necessities just to get us moving?
Journeyman's face wrinkled as if he just caught a whiff of something foul.
Skipper!
He protested. Grimm let a hint of calm, cool steel creep into his voice.
I'm a captain. Humor me. How long?
The engineer scratched at the back of his neck, muttering. Then he said,
Maybe a week.
Run round-the-clock work shifts,
Grimm said.
And if you can find any bonded local engineers, we'll hire them on.
Journeyman stared at Grimm as though Grimm had just suggested that the engineer should prostitute his mother to pirates.
In my engine room. Skip.
Do it, Chief, Grimm said.
That's an order. Journeyman muttered a bit more savagely under his breath.
A few days, then. For that, you get the most pathetic, slipshod, half-assed, rickety, unreliable, accident-prone potential disaster in the history of the airship.
I have every faith in you, Chief,
Grimm said, turning to go.
Draw funds as you need them, and get to it.
Chapter 29 Spire Albion, Habel Landing 4 weeks ago, Bridget had lived a quiet and sensible existence, she thought. She worked with her father, took care of their customers, and often visited her poorer neighbours, bringing gifts of meat that hadn't sold and needed to be eaten. She attended school every other day, and occasionally ventured to the market to purchase what their home and business needed. She had been to the amphitheatre half a dozen times to attend musical concerts, and gone bi-weekly to services at the Church of God in Heaven. And now, she thought, she was wandering through a strange and possibly dangerous Habel, her only companions, a cat who regarded himself as the world's preeminent being, and a rather reedy girl who kept up a steady, muttered conversation with her jar of used crystals. What if she got lost? What if she came upon more footpads? What if she found the enemy before she made contact with the local cats? At least in Habel Morning, she'd had the implied authority of her uniform to hide behind. Now she wore only her regular clothes. Granted, the wide sleeves of her blouse concealed the gauntlet on her left hand almost completely, but she'd scarcely had time to learn to discharge one without killing someone by accident, much less doing so by conscious intention. She doubted her ability to hit a target more than 3 or 4 feet away if it came to a genuine combat situation. She wasn't sure whether that made her better off than if she was completely unarmed, or worse. Raoul rode on her shoulder, his head held at a high, cocky angle, as though he had recently conquered the place, laying a benign gaze upon his realm and subjects as their little party walked through one of the wider and more crowded tunnels of the Habel's first level. The cat's nose never stopped twitching, and his ears flicked around alertly.
"Honestly, Raoul," Bridget murmured, "are you certain you're watching for the local cats?"
"Even the sharpest eyes cannot see what is not there, little mouse,"
Raoul replied serenely.
"Keep walking. Over toward those cooking places."
"I bought you a dumpling not half an hour ago,"
Bridget protested.
Those smell good to me, and I want to smell them some more,
Raoul said.
Any other cat worth a name would feel exactly the same way. Perhaps we will see them there.
And perhaps, as long as we're there, you'll have another bite.
Perhaps I shall.
I should make you carry your pay around yourself.
Metal circles, Raoul scoffed. They are a human madness. A human should deal with them.
He's right,
Folly put in, from where she walked, so close to Bridget's flank that Bridget feared to turn toward her too quickly, lest she strike her with an elbow in the process.
Money is madness. A delusion. Illusion. It's not made of metal, really.
It's made of time. How much is one's time worth?
If one can convince enough people that one's time is an invaluable resource, then one has lots and lots of money. That's why one can spend time.
Only one can never get a refund.
I see, Bridget said, though she didn't. Well, in any case, shall we go over there?
Folly leaned down and whispered to her jar.
She spoils the cat.
A privilege I do not give to just anyone,
Raoul said smugly. Folly suddenly stopped in her tracks and let out a harsh hiss. Bridget turned to the other girl as pedestrians nearly walked into her back and began to paw impatiently around her. The etherealist's apprentice was standing with her back, ramrod straight, her mismatched eyes very wide.
Folly,
Bridget said.
It's here,
Folly said in a whisper.
It's watching. We would tell Bridget about it if we could.
They were getting a few glares and mutters now, as they slowed the foot traffic around them. Bridget didn't mind glowers and low curses, but she found herself very much concerned that their disruption of foot traffic called a great deal of attention to the two young women. It was quite the opposite of operating covertly. She took Folly's arm firmly and guided the girl onto a side path.
Folly, she asked, what's here? What's watching?
Bridget doesn't know about the grim captain's visitors,
Folly said, her eyes darting around.
But they're looking at us right now.
Bridget blinked. Captain Grimm's visitor? Do you mean that Commodore?
The one with the very large hat,
Raoul added helpfully.
She doesn't understand,
Folly said to the jar.
These came before that. When the master treated the grim captain on the day before they met.
I'm a bit confused, Bridget said politely. Master Ferris treated Captain Grimm before meeting him?
Folly whispered to her jar.
If she keeps repeating everything I say, this is going to take much more time.
She glanced around them and slowly exhaled.
There, I think, yes, there. We're alone now. Folly, I need you to help me understand, Bridget said. Are you talking about Aurorans?
Folly blinked several times and then said, her tone thoughtful,
She brings up an excellent point. Possibly. I feel awful, and I think I'll sit down.
The etherealist's apprentice sat down on the ground as if entirely exhausted, her knees curled up to her chest, her eyes sunken. She leaned her head back against the spire stone wall.
Miss Folly, Bridget said, are you quite all right?
Folly patted her jar as a mother might a restless child and said,
It's all right.
Bridget doesn't know how hard it is to hear things. Tell her that we're just tired and we need a moment.
I see,
Bridget said.
She tilted her head, studying the other girl thoughtfully. She'd regarded Folly as someone who must have fallen into some kind of premature dotage, but her answers were canny enough, if phrased quite oddly. Folly had said that she would have told Bridget something if she could, though by the simple act of saying as much, she had accomplished it.
I noticed, Bridget said, that Master Ferris seems to have difficulties with doorknobs.
She doesn't know that the Master is far too brilliant for such things, Folly said, nodding.
And you, Bridget continued thoughtfully, seem to have difficulty speaking directly to others.
Oh, she uses her eyes, and what's behind them as well, Folly said to her jar with a weary little smile. That's two in 1 week. Perhaps I should write down the date.
Remarkable, Bridget said. Miss, I am very sorry if I said anything to offend you, or if I haven't paid attention when you meant me to hear something. I didn't understand.
Raoul leaned down to peer at Folly.
She seemed no more ridiculous to me than most humans.
At that, Folly looked up and beamed a smile at Raoul.
Oh, he doesn't know that that's the kindest thing anyone's said about me since the Master called me a gnat-catcher.
And now we're back to being very odd, Bridget said. But I shall try to make allowances for it, since we're to be working together.
Bridget felt Raoul's paw tap her cheek, and she turned her head in that direction. The side lane where they'd stopped was dimly lit, even by the standards of Habble Landing. It reminded her of the tunnel where the footpads had lurked. For a second she didn't see whatever Raoul had warned her about. But then there was a flicker of light, and she saw a pair of green-gold eyes staring at them from the shadows, and around them was a grey-furred shape. A cat. Bridget made a basket of her arms, and Raoul leapt down to them, and then to the ground. The ginger cat ambled calmly down the alley toward the other feline. Then he sat down a few feet away from the other cat, ignored him entirely, and began to fastidiously groom his paws. The stranger cat emerged from the gloom and sat down a bit closer to Raoul. Then he, too, promptly ignored the other cat and began grooming.
Oh,
Folly asked ajar,
do you think Bridget knows if that is cat diplomacy?
They've never explained it to me, but it's more of a power struggle, I think, Bridget replied. I'm fairly sure it's about establishing which of them is the least impressed by the other.
I wonder what is being established.
A more capable cat is never impressed by a less capable cat.
Oh,
Folly said.
I see what she's saying now. They're seeing which of them is the proudest.
Bridget sighed and nodded.
Or at least which has the biggest ego.
By ignoring each other, Folly said.
Yes.
Folly frowned down at her jar.
I don't know all about cats like Bridget, but it seems to me that this could be a prolonged contest. It often is. I wonder what we should do to hurry things along,
Folly said to her jar.
Hurry two cats? Bridget asked, smiling at Raoul. No, the cats didn't come to our Habble looking for our help, Miss Folly. This is their custom. Their way. We shall wait.
We shall wait for 3 hours, apparently,
Folly yawned to her jar of crystals.
One learns patience working in a vattery, Bridget said. It doesn't matter how much one wants a batch to be done. It won't happen any faster. It's the same with cats.
Folly leaned down to her jar and whispered,
I don't think cats grow in vats, but we shouldn't say so aloud, for that might hurt her feelings and be unkind.
You know what I meant, Bridget said, though that was very amusing.
The other girl smiled downward, clearly pleased.
So few people understand my jokes. Usually they just give me very strange looks.
I'm the girl who associates with cats, Bridget said. Please believe that I know precisely the look you mean.
Bridget checked on Raoul again, but the two cats remained locked in their war of mutual indifference.
I've been thinking about what the Spyrarch said earlier, about the nature of Master Ferris's mission.
She means secret mission,
Folly said to her jar.
Did he tell you what he was up to?
Folly traced a fingertip along the outside of the jar. It might have been Bridget's imagination, but the tiny crystals inside seemed to give off the faintest glow of light where Folly's fingertip touched the glass.
Bridget doesn't understand the Master very well,
she said.
He guards knowledge like a bank guards coins. So, you don't exactly know what he's looking for either.
Folly smiled faintly without looking up.
He gave me few pennies.
They're quite frightful.
Bridget frowned. But surely it isn't difficult to deduce that he means to locate the Auroran infiltrators and foil their plans.
Bridget's logic seems sound, Folly said.
I was thinking almost the same thing.
Bridget nodded.
We're seeking the help of Albion cats to thwart the Aurorans. But they've been so successful at keeping their movements concealed that we still have no idea exactly where they are. That seems a remarkable accomplishment, to descend through the vents of half the habbles of a spire without being observed by a cat somewhere. They must be doing something to make sure they go unseen. Do you think it possible that the Aurorans are also using cats as scouts, Folly?
The Etherealist's apprentice ducked her head a little at the mention of her name. The pitch of her voice dropped to a bare, low whisper.
Not cats. Not cats.
Not cats, Bridget said. It's something else, then. Something that frightens you.
It's a terrifying penny,
Folly said to her little jar.
I'm slightly mad,
but not a fool.
If Bridget knew, she'd be as afraid as I am.
Bridget felt a chill run neatly up her spine and leaned toward Folly, speaking more quietly.
You mean something from...
Her mouth felt quite dry and she swallowed.
From the surface?
It wasn't unheard of for the creatures of the surface to gain access to a spire. In fact, the smaller beasts did so regularly. A spire contained literally hundreds of miles of ventilation tunnels and ducts, water channels, cisterns, sewage channels, and compost chambers. Metal grates were regularly installed where they could be, but constant contact with the outer atmosphere degraded their cladding and eventually left them vulnerable to iron rot. Cats did far more to protect the residents of any spire than humans realized, by hunting and killing such intruders. Granted, the lovely little bullies would have done so in any case, and not simply for food, but because they loved the hunt. Most folk tended to assume that cats preyed solely upon rodents and the like, which was certainly true. But in fact, by working cooperatively, a tribe of cats could stalk and bring down prey considerably larger than themselves. Sometimes, however, something too large and too dangerous for cats to handle managed to enter a spire's tunnels. That was why every habble employed verminositors, men and women who hunted such predators professionally, who maintained and repaired the defensive grates, and who tracked and killed nightmarish interlopers before the beasts could begin hunting the people of a spire. But those were wild creatures. If somehow the Aurorans had managed to train something from the surface to fight with their military. There were many stories and books and dramas written around the concept of some misguided soul attempting to tame the creatures of the surface, to train them to do their will. Such fictional figures universally met an identical fate, agony and death at the hands of their would-be pets. Generally after a great loss of life, wild beasts could not be tamed. They could not be controlled. That was, after all, what made them wild.
They don't belong here, and they want to destroy us,
Folly said to her jar, her eyes sick but her tone matter-of-fact.
All of us. They don't care what spire we call home.
Well, Bridget said, if the Aurorans truly are playing with that fire, it's only a matter of time before it burns them.
I once had a dream of the world,
Folly said. She gave Bridget's face a quick flicking glance before looking down again.
And it all burned.
Bridget felt a shiver gather at the nape of her neck, and she said nothing. She looked away, back toward Raoul, waiting.
Chapter 30. Spire Albion, Habel Landing, The Black Horse Inn. Benedict fetched their drinks when the bartender waved at them, and Master Ferris seized his rather large mug of beer with obvious enthusiasm and began tilting it back at once.
"Goodness," Gwen said, shaking her head. "I'm quite certain that a gentleman does not simply attack a drink so."
Ferris lowered the mug and wiped foam from his upper lip, beaming.
"No, indeed, he does not. Fortunately, I am absent any of the qualities that make a gentleman, and thus need not bother with the gentlemanly approach."
He waved his empty mug at the bartender and said,
"Another, Sir Benedict."
Benedict, who had just sat, gave the old man a rather lopsided smile and then rose again, without complaint, to make another trek across the room and back. He came back with one enormous mug in each hand and set them both down before Ferris. The old etherealist beamed and said,
"A man who plans ahead, foresight, always foresight, it's the first trait of any formidable person at all."
"I just hoped to be able to sample mine before I had to get up again," Benedict said, and sipped demonstratively at his own drink.
"How's your tea, Cuz?"
"Perfectly tepid," Gwendolyn answered, but she added a dollop of honey to it in any case, stirred it, and sipped. Even scarcely warm tea was tea, thank goodness, and something that felt very normal amidst all the strange events of the past few days.
"Master Ferris."
"My word."
Ferris lowered the second emptied mug, coughed out a quiet, rather unobtrusive little belch, and smiled at her.
"Yes, child?"
"I take it that you are not obliterating your good sense for no reason whatsoever."
He narrowed his eyes at her and gave Benedict a shrewdly conspiratorial glance.
"Doesn't miss much, does she?"
"Despite what everyone tends to think, no," Benedict agreed in a polite tone. "I think she rather enjoys letting everyone believe she's too self-absorbed to notice anything that's happening around her."
"It's either that or let them think I'm some vapid twit, like Mother," Gwen said. "I simply can't bring myself to stoop that low."
Ferris nodded sagely.
"No, no, not a bit like your mother. Can't have that."
He took the third mug in a comfortable grasp and smiled.
"In fact, you are quite right, Miss Lancaster. There is a method to my madness. Well, to this particular madness, at any rate."
He took a deep draught from the third mug, though at least he hadn't finished it in a single gulp.
"And what would that be?" Gwen prompted him.
"You must understand something of what we do," Ferris said, "or this will seem like foolishness."
"We? Etherealists, you mean?"
"Precisely,"
Ferris said, with another politely suppressed belch.
"A great deal of what we strive to achieve happens as an instinct, I suppose one might say. We touch upon forces that others cannot sense."
"You mean the ether?"
Ferris waved a hand in a rather exaggerated gesture.
"That's simplifying a monstrously complex concept to its barest core, but yes, that will do. We sense etheric forces. Most people do, to some degree, though they rarely realize it."
"I'm sure I don't know what you mean," Gwen said.
"In fact, you do,"
Ferris replied.
"That gauntlet you're wearing, for example?"
"Yes."
"What do you feel in it?"
"Nothing in particular," Gwen replied. "The crystal is a bit cool against my palm, but it always is."
"In strictest point of fact, miss, it isn't,"
Ferris said.
"If you found yourself a thermometer and compared the crystal's temperature to that of your skin, you would find them to be almost precisely the same."
Gwen frowned.
"I assure you, sir, it is quite cool."
"It isn't," Ferris replied. "What you feel is the etheric energy that courses through the crystal. But your sensation of it is something
Your mind was not sure what to do with when you first encountered it. A wonderful place, the mind. But if it has any kind of disappointing failure, it's that it always attempts to put new things into the context of things which are already familiar to it. So your mind apparently decided, upon encountering this new sensation, that it might just as well label it cold and get on with your day. And you are far from alone. It's one of the more common reactions to the first direct exposure to an intense field of etheric energy.
The crystal on my gauntlet tingles, Benedict said, nodding, a bit like when you've fallen asleep on your hand and the blood comes rushing back in. Though I'd never heard it explained in quite those terms before, Master Ferris.
That sounds like nonsense, Gwen said. Something is cold or it isn't, sir.
Ah, Ferris said, pointing a finger at her. I had no idea you had an interest in philosophy. Splendid!
I beg your pardon, Gwen said. I never mentioned philosophy.
Didn't you? Ferris replied. You just heard Sir Benedict confirm that his experience with a weapons crystal was significantly different from your own. There is but one reality. That is true, but the two of you experience it in slightly different ways. The older you get, I should think, the more you will come to understand that the universe is very much a looking glass, Miss Lancaster.
Meaning what, precisely?
That it reflects a great deal more of yourself to your senses than you probably know. Rubbish.
If I look at a blue coat, I see a blue coat. The fact that I'm looking doesn't change that.
Ah, Ferris said, raising a finger. But suppose that what you see as the colour blue is the same shade that Sir Benedict sees when he looks at something you would call green.
But that doesn't happen, Gwen said.
Well, how do you know? Ferris replied. Can you see with Sir Benedict's eyes? And if you can, I should love to know the trick of it.
Gwen blinked several times. So you're saying that it's possible that when I see blue, he sees green?
Not at all. He sees the colour blue,
the etherealist said.
But his colour blue, not yours.
Gwen frowned. She opened her mouth to object again, thought about it, and put her teeth together. And if Benedict does, then perhaps everyone else does too?
Benedict smiled down at his cup. It would do a great deal to explain the aesthetic tastes of House Astor, he must admit.
Oh, Gwen said with a shudder. Yes, those people simply cannot coordinate their wardrobes properly.
Now then, Ferris said, after another pull from his mug. That's something perfectly simple and relatively minor. Colours. What if other fundamental aspects of life seem quite different to others? What if their experience of heat and cold is different? What if they sense pleasure or pain differently? What if, to their eyes, gravity draws objects sideways instead of down? How would we know the difference, eh?
We've all learned to call the same phenomena by certain names from the time we are quite small, after all.
We could see things in utterly unique and amazing ways and be quite ignorant of the fact.
That sounds remarkably slipshod, Gwen said. I'm sure that God in heaven would not have created the world and its residents in such a ramshackle fashion.
Ah, Ferris said, beaming. There. You are a philosopher already. A great many reasonable folk who have gone before you have put forth a similar argument.
The real question, of course, Benedict said, is why on earth it matters. After all, we seem to have a common frame of reference for blue, and when she says blue, I know what she's talking about, even if my blue is her green.
It matters because it is philosophy,
Ferris replied, with an expression of sly wisdom. If all philosophers took questions like yours seriously, Sir Benedict, they'd find themselves straight out of a career now, wouldn't they?
Gwen sipped at her tea, frowning some more.
But
I'm not saying that I agree with your proposition, of course, Master Ferris, but let us suppose that you are correct for the sake of argument.
Let us suppose,
Ferris said. Then it would mean that, for all practical purposes, each of us lives in our own universe, Spire, would it not? Perceiving all of it in our own fashion.
Go on, Ferris said.
Well, Gwen said, if that is the case, then it seems quite remarkable to me that we've managed to establish any kind of communication at all.
Ferris arched an eyebrow.
Quick study, Miss Lancaster, very quick.
Indeed, when we connect with our fellow mortal souls, something quite remarkable has happened, and perhaps one day, if we all work at it diligently and manage not to exterminate one another, we may even be able to see through one another's eyes.
He beamed. But for now, we'll have to make do with making good guesses, I suppose. Food for thought. He finished the third mug in another pull and waved for more. Benedict cleared his throat.
Master Ferris, I'm afraid we've wandered from the original point.
Have we? Why are you getting drunk?
Her cousin prompted gently.
Ah,
Ferris said.
He held out his empty mug to Benedict.
Would you mind terribly?
Your turn, I think, cuz, Benedict said easily. Gwen sighed and fetched another pair of mugs for the Etherealist.
Lovely, Ferris said, and gulped some more. Perceptions of etheric energy change from mind to mind, just as you and Sir Benedict demonstrate with your weapons crystals. And if one changes one's mind, that also changes the nature of those perceptions. This will allow me to perceive those energies in ways in which I would not normally be able to do so.
You're getting drunk, Gwen said slowly, so that you can experience etheric energy differently.
Ferris held up his mug and said solemnly,
think of it as goggles for one's mind instead of one's eyes.
Benedict sipped at his drink, frowning.
You think you'll be able to sense the Auroran's weapons crystals?
Ferris waved a hand.
No, no. There are so many of those things about. It would be like searching for a needle in a barge load of needles.
Gwen turned her teacup idly in her hands and said abruptly,
you think there's another Etherealist here, don't you? And you think that by changing your mind, it will be easier for you to find him.
Ferris nodded, though the gesture made his head wobble a bit.
Top marks.
He put away another mug, and this time his finishing belch was rather louder.
Extrapolate.
Benedict suddenly smiled. If you could sense him, he could sense you. So you're also changing your mind to make that more difficult. Ferris slurred his sibilance severely.
Astute, sir. Sincerely astute.
He peered down toward the bottom of his mug.
Though, I confess, I have not changed my mind quite this thoroughly in some time.
Why? Gwen asked. I mean, why do you believe there's another person like you here?
Oh, it's complicated, Ferris said.
Or I seem to remember that it is, at any rate.
The Auroran fleet, Benedict said thoughtfully. Their attack was precise, as if they'd had some kind of beacon to show them exactly where to dive through the mists.
Could an Etherealist manage such a thing, sir?
I dare say, Ferris said.
Gwen set her teacup aside. And have you changed your mind sufficiently to locate this person?
Ferris eyed her, and then his mug unsteadily.
It would seem not. But it's likely a question of distance, methinks. If we get closer, I'll have a better sense of it.
And that's why you're contacting the local cats, Gwen said,
to give you an idea of where to start looking.
Time, Ferris said. There's no time for a search pattern.
He closed his eyes for a moment, and Gwen thought that he suddenly looked several years older and several years wearier.
There's never enough time, you know.
Gwen traded a frown with her cousin.
Sir?
Ferris shook his head. He took a swallow from the mug and put it down again.
Time to slow down now, I think.
Gwen nodded and felt somewhat relieved.
Too much of such an indulgence can be dangerous, sir. What now?
Now?
Ferris sighed without opening his eyes.
Now we wait.
Is that wise, sir? Benedict asked politely. You do say that we're short on time.
We always are, Ferris said. At the moment, it is all we can do, I'm afraid.
Best get comfortable.
Gwen and Benedict traded another look, and Gwen nodded firmly.
In that case, she said, I shall ask for properly hot tea.
Chapter 31 Spire Albion, Havel Landing Shipyards, AMS Predator. The door to Grimm's cabin opened a few inches, and Kettle said,
Skipper, something you want to see.
Grimm blinked his eyes open, long accustomed reflexes, swinging his legs out of his bunk and his feet to the floor before he was able to focus his gaze. Night had fallen, and the cabin was lit only by the light of a few large lumen crystals that were hung around landings at shipyards, shining wanly through the small windows. He felt as though some kind of gum were squeezing his eyelids shut. But he knew it was nothing more than simple weariness. He must have been asleep for less than 3 or 4 hours for his body to feel so reluctant to get out of his bed.
Skipper!
Grimm felt an irrational surge of annoyance at the pilot, and promptly clubbed it into submission. Kettle hadn't slept much more than Grimm had, and the man wouldn't have woken him if it wasn't important.
I hear you, Mr. Kettle. I'll be out directly.
Aye, sir!
Kettle said quietly, and closed the door. Grimm fumbled a lumen crystal to life, quickly washed himself from a basin of tepid water, and dressed. Captains did not arrive to address a crisis looking like an unmade bed. They were always calm, confident, and neatly turned out. If an enemy battleship was about to unleash a full broadside on a ship, the captain would face it with his hat straight and his cravat crisp and square. Anything else undermined the faith of a crew, increasing the chances of casualties, and was therefore unacceptable. That said, the captain knew very well how time-critical any number of issues could be. On a fleet ship, Grimm would have had a personal valet to manage a good many things, and save him considerable personal time on a given day. But Predator, as a private vessel, could not afford the luxury. The upshot being that it took him nearly 4 minutes, instead of 3, to cleanse himself, dress, buckle on his sword, tug his hat on firmly, and appear on the deck. His arm ached restlessly without its sling, and he could have done with a shave. But all things considered, it could wait until morning.
"The time, Mr. Kettle?"
Grimm asked as he emerged.
6th bell.
Kettle replied. 3 o'clock, sir.
Grimm strode to the ship's starboard rail and scowled up into the misty night sky at the vessel that was making its descent to the landing slip beside Predator's. She was a large, armed merchantman, a third again Predator's size, flying a Delosian flag this night. She had been painted smuggler black all across her hull, though there were sharp white marks painted on her decks to show the way to her crew in darkness. Like Predator, she had masts for raising sail when the use of her web was not possible, though Grimm knew her sails to be stained storm-cloud grey and smudged with black smoke. A blazon of garish red paint at her prow named her the Mist Shark.
"There, you see, sir?"
Kettle growled.
What's she doing here?
Whatever it is, Grimm mused, I think we can safely assume it's unlikely to make our sleep more restful.